In 1967, early June, I was on WABC radio. Matter of fact, in those days, we called it WA Beatles-C radio. The Beatles were quite dominant, although we went through a time when we were a little worried. There was no product. There was no Beatle record. The Beatlemaniacs were getting very worried, and the guys on the air, like your cousin Bruce, where are my Beatles? And then the rumors started coming out that something was going on in Great Britain, that they were recording something special. You know, but at this time, they were kind of down on, well, they didn't want to do any more appearances. They had that terrible time in the Philippines where they were almost expelled, if they weren't expelled from the country. There was a lot of turmoil over there. So Paul and John, and Paul, by the way, was the one who wanted to continue all the tours. Even he was getting kind of tired of it. So they decided to go home, concentrate, learn more about music, which, by the way, this was a very good period, not only for the things they wrote, but they learned different instruments. They learned about music. So it was a very important time. And while they were doing this, recording techniques were changing. And amazing things were happening in the music industry. And I think we have the Beatles to thank for that.
Well, what do you, there were some people among the rumors that were buzzing around, you know, was it the Beatles were losing some steam, you know, like there were like 10,000 open seats in Shea Stadium in 66. And, you know, some of the media were kind of anxious to say that the bloom was off the Beatles. Was there anything about that in the buzz at WABC?
No, I think we were just concerned. I don't think we ever thought that they were losing steam. It was too early. I mean, I never thought they'd get up to steam, very honestly. As a Beatle maniac myself and an expert and knowing the boys, I never thought it would reach the peak that it did, you know, by 65 and then 66. But by 1967, things were changing. The world was changing. The American music, the American recording industry was gaining more steam. The Beatles were not putting out product. They spent a lot of time on the road, you know, trying to make a buck. And they realized pretty soon this was not the place to do it. I had no doubt that something was going to happen. I don't think the Beatles ever lost their steam. I think they needed some time to regroup and learn about themselves and learn about music.
Do you have any special recollections about the first times of playing Sgt. Pepper on the air or the album coming into the station and you hearing it for the first time?
Gee, I remember in May, or maybe even April, I started getting little pieces, little segments of what they were doing. You know, a couple, they started leaking out some of the tracks from the Sgt. Pepper album, which, by the way, included the Penny Lane and the Strawberry Fields, because that Strawberry Fields was really the first record, as you know, that was written for Sgt. Pepper. And eventually, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields, they would put that on the side for the Magical album. I started hearing things like this, and I said, oh, they're still there. They still got it. And I really was a suspect of the recording industry, their record company, their producer, of holding things back. Because they wanted, I think, you know, the Beatles were always very dramatic. Everything they did, Paul is dead, Paul is not dead, John won't talk to Paul. Everything they did, they try to cause some kind of commotion, an international scandal or international concern. So I just knew from the past that something was going on. And then hearing some of these things from we didn't know what the album was called. I didn't even know what they were doing. I didn't know they were working on a concept album. Although Paul told me, I asked Paul once, I'll never forget this, you know, what he thought the greatest album of all time was. And he said, Beach Boys' Pet Sound to me. And I said, well, why? Pet Sound's all right, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe I never understood it. And he said, it was a concept. And I said, what do you mean? He says, you'll understand someday. All right? That's exactly what he said to me. So, yep. By 1967 in June, I guess I got it. I really did get it. The word concept came out. But they really revolutionized everything. And they were causing this revolution silently underground until they released that album.
Mm-hmm. Did the album sound unusual to you? I mean, those songs were quite different in some ways than what the top 40 was playing at the time. Do you have any recollection of, you know, just your impressions of whether the record would play on AM radio?
Well, AM radio, as you know, was being forced to change. We were playing things, you know, besides some of the top 40, we were playing a few things. And if you take a look at the charts, some of the things were a little more advanced. But there was no doubt in my mind that when I first heard the actual Sgt. Pepper recording, the album, and I said, wow, this is not what Cousin Brucey's been playing, you know, since the 50s. But things have changed. I mean, just the recording technique alone, the recording technique with the bouncing down, you know, is really using these mono and stereo and mixing the four tracks. You know, they didn't have multi-head recordings in those days. That was coming out a year or so later. So they used to use whatever they had. They had mono, they had stereo, and they'd mix everything. They took techniques that were never used before, and the engineers over at Abbey Road did some amazing things with what I would call very primitive equipment. So when I first heard Sergeant Pepper, I said, wow, I wonder if my audience is going to understand this. This is very different. It's very advanced. It's going to change the face of rock and roll forever. And I'll tell you, it did.
And then what kind of reactions did you get from listeners? Do you recall?
Well, yes. Well, when the listeners first heard it, I got a little concerned because every time you'd play a new Beatle record on the air, the phones would light up instantly and they'd say to me something like, hello, Cousin Brucey. Everybody had an English accent. But people were losing the English accents because we haven't heard anything for weeks and weeks and weeks. And they say, hey, Brucey, what was that you just played? Was that the Beatles? What was all that stuff? Can you play it again? They wanted to hear it again. But at first, it was a little slow, and then it just caught on like wildfire. And Sergeant Pepper just took off. The audience understood it. They realized that it was time to move to the next step in rock and roll. And who better than the Beatles to lead us there? We trusted them.
So I noticed on the charts, as I look back at the WABC archives, that Sergeant Pepper was played. It was listed below the chart, actually, as album tracks that were played for several weeks. And then I noticed that, you know, no Pepper tracks were listed on the WABC charts. But do you all remember, do you remember playing it throughout the summer, those album tracks, even though they weren't listed in the top 40?
You know, we had this top 40 survey. We did this research called Record Stores, and they did research from all over. The only people I didn't research with are the listeners, which to me is the most important people to research. But that's not what they believed in those days. There wasn't a Beatles song on the charts for weeks and weeks and weeks. However, when Sgt. Pepper album came out, when the album came out, suddenly WA Beatles C, which never played album cuts, very rarely, they play it by a superstar, they play one cut. Suddenly, they were sort of slipping in one, two, three cuts from the Sgt. Pepper album. Albeit, unfortunately, we in those days we were very paranoid about the FCC and about the government, the Justice Department coming down on, quote, drug-related lyrics. I mean, we were so crazy. We couldn't play Snowbird. Peter, Paul, and Mary, Puff the Magic Dragon was taken off the list. I mean, it was instant terrible paranoia. So here you have things like A Day in the Life, which to me is one, you know, if people ask me my favorite song of all time, I say A Day in the Life. And why? Well, it's an opera. I did not look at it as a drug-related testimonial. We played Lucy in the Sky. Now, Lucy in the Sky certainly is a psychedelic of song, and it could be considered drug related, although John came on the air with me and swore that it was Julian's drawing from his day school, and they drew us a picture of a little Lucy, a little girl in the sky with some stars. We did play some of them. We didn't play the most important ones, and to me, A Day in the Life was one of the most important records ever recorded. You know, we played Sgt. Pepper with a little help from my friends. By the way, that was kind of interesting. The early labels, which I have one, it came out with A Little Help with My Friends. You know, these are little nuances, but the actual title later on was With A Little Help from My Friends, because John complained about that. And even that song, Help, they considered to be a little drug-related. I just think we were just over-cautious. But for the first time, Top 40 Radio went to album. Maybe that's where AOR was born. Because of Sgt. Pepper, another renovation.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. What do you remember thinking about WORFM and the various FM college stations that were playing the heavier sounds and album cuts at the time? Were you kind of aware of that, like keeping an eye on it as a radio guy?
As a radio person, I was always very interested in new technologies, of course, and especially new formats. And when the WOR came out and we had what they called album-oriented rock, yeah, I was listening to it. It interested me a little bit, but I never thought anything would ever happen with it. I thought it was just too narrow for broadcasting. I'm a broadcaster. I'm not a narrowcaster. So I would like to play some of the cuts they played from albums, but I also wanted to play my top 50 and my top 100 and then go back to my oldies. I like the broad range, and that's what I'm doing today on Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm a broadcaster.
Yeah. So there wasn't really a sense that what ended up happening with FM is it sort of discovered this countercultural underground audience at the time in 66 and early 67. What it sounds like you're telling me is that most folks in radio weren't aware that this tribe was gathering, basically.
No, I think everybody in broadcasting was very aware of the underground banana smoking jocks on the air with FM in those days. And they were trying to be very different. They cut commercials down a little bit. They were playing these 6 and 7, 8 minute tracks. They always sound like they were eating too much Jell-O or chocolate pudding. You know, they try to be very cool about it. But I knew that eventually there had to be a combo, a melding of the formats, which is eventually what happened, because this kind of broadcasting, the playing the 6 minute records and sounding, hey man, I want you to listen to this 7 minute track, man, this is the way it goes. You know, that kind of very cool approach, very natural. I knew that there would be a blending of that and Cousin Brucey's kind of radio top 40. And that's very honestly where it happened. And by the 70s, by the early 70s, we were really becoming a blending of top 40 and AOR type music.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I think that's most of what I needed to cover. Is there anything else that you jotted down or thought about when you were thinking about this interview, Pepper-related, or memories that you have about...
For an album that really changed the course of not only the creative part, but also the technical part, which was recorded in about 130 days of actual work... It's the most amazing event, and I think it's probably the, magnum effort ever in recording. And an amazing, once again, the Beatles once again did it and creatively and technically. We owe the Beatles an awful lot to where we are in recording technology and recording creativity today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing story.
It is. It really is. I don't think it. No, we didn't realize it. I mean, when this thing came out, you know, we didn't know concept. We didn't know what concept meant. I mean, it, you know, when you think about it, even the album cover was revolutionary, albeit quite primitive. It was before Photoshop, and it was slapped together and, you know, pasted together like they used to. But even the artwork, they thought about how they can make this thing very, very differently. I didn't know what a concept album meant. I just thought a concept album would have some kind of a conceptual, you know, running storyline, and it didn't. It didn't have that. I mean, it had a feeling, but it didn't have an actual story. But that's what was so wonderful about the Beatles. They were abstract. They weren't right to the money, right to the point. A guy like myself, you know, when I hear about concept, I want to hear a storyline. Well, there was no real storyline, you know, until their movies came out. And that was so great about it. And then maybe a decade or so later, I said, oh, I got it. It took me that long. But I believe the audience got it right away. The audience understood what they were doing. And so did everybody else in the recording industry. A new era was born thanks to the Beatles.
Yeah, and the last thing that comes to mind is I guess that you would be a good person to ask about this sort of... sea change in album cover art. I read somebody had said, after Sgt. Pepper, you know, nobody put out a boring album cover. And that made me remember how boring album covers were. I mean, maybe you could, remember what a typical album cover looked like before the Beatles, you know, because you saw so many of them.
Right.
How would you describe the typical album cover before Sgt. Pepper?
All right. The recording industry is very traditional, reasonably conservative. They have an attitude, unfortunately, which was proven over the 60s and in the 70s and the 50s. If it's not broke, don't fix it, you know? Leave it alone. So album covers were dull. They were boring. They had a picture of the artist or the group with some very boring font, some very boring text on it. Nothing original. Just right in your face with the person's picture. Here's Joe Stafford. Here's Frank Sinatra. You know, and that right in your face, right? And that, thanks to the Beatles once again, who, you know, these were guys that were not recording industry moguls. They were guys from Liverpool. They were guys who had new vision. They were young. They wanted to try things. So by the time of 66 came around, 67, 65, they had their freedom. And their intellect was developing, and their psychological feeling was developing, their emotion was developing, and they decided that, hey, let's be a little different, let's develop a little more, let's not stay in 1950 or early 1960, let's come out with something different. So they came out with music, oh, they were still singing about their lives a lot, all right? They were still thinking about the music and the lyrics about where they grew up, but they were presenting it differently because, as I said, and I always said, they learned about their music. They learned instrumentation. They learned about different instruments, and they started using it, the mellotron, the sitar, and things like that. Nobody ever did things like that. And then they said, look, let's do something else, too. I don't want to see another Meet the Beatles picture. That's boring. So they came up with this concept, this art concept, albeit still very primitive, by the way. The art was not as advanced as the recording, but it started something, another revolution in the business. I think the Sgt. Pepper album, since that album cover came out, there's very rarely been a very boring album cover in the recording industry, because the recording industry said, hey, we better wake up. It's 1967. Things are changing. Yeah. The Beatles changed that again.
Wow. Cousin Brucey, it is so much fun to talk to you, and I really, really appreciate you letting us come into your apartment and take some time with me.
That's great. Paul, when you get it, I'd love to hear this, and love to know what it's on. And listen, my book, as I told you, a little promo here, a little commercial. My book will be out probably in September. You'll probably get advanced copies. Sterling Publishing is going to take it. And it's really a sociological book. It's called Doo-Wop, but don't let that scare you, because it has a huge scope.
Yeah, I'm going to probably put this interview on my website. So tell me a little bit about the book you're at it.
Okay. I'm very excited about something. The book that has been within me, in my body, for probably all my young adult life, which still is, by the way, young adult. It's called Doo-Wop. It's being published by Sterling Publishers in New York City. They published a book called Hippie, by the way. This book has been living within me for a long time. It's not only about the doo-wop, the vocal harmony groups, but it's all about how music developed. I start with the caveman, and I go through the slavery, I go through Africa, I go through the blues, gospel, I go through jazz, and I talk about the development till we get up to doo-wop, and I end sort of with the British invasion, where the Beatles came over. It's profusely illustrated, hundreds and hundreds of pictures, gorgeously designed, and like I said, every page looks like a fireworks. It's a party. It's a table, one of these tabletop books. And it's due to be published and released, I think, in September of 07. So this is a very exciting moment for me. It's something like a baby of mine is going to be born.
Well, Doo-Wop really inspired a lot of people that you didn't really maybe know that it inspired. Like, I just am working on a program on Paul Simon, who was like one of the great Doo-Wop fans. And
oh, sure.
You know, it had a bigger impact, I think, than some people think about it anymore.
Well,
but
let me tell you, Bruce Springsteen and Paul Simon, and you can go on and on, and a lot of the hip-hop groups were inspired, and they were led on by the so-called vocal harmony groups that we got to call doo-wop. Very influential on music, but doo-wop was influenced by much earlier groups. I mean, earlier music, the blues and jazz, and big bands even. And
yeah.
You go back to the Ink Spots.
The Ink Spots,
and the Mills Brothers. Yeah. I mean, you're talking real American music history here. So that's what this book is going to be about.
Yeah, my dad had those old Ink Spots and Mills Brothers 78s.
Now, are you aware, this is kind of interesting for you, Paul, to know, those records, you go back, you know, they had maybe a piano and maybe a little percussion on it. Mm. All the music you heard on there, you thought you heard on there, was emulated by the human voice. All those early groups made themselves sound like musical instruments.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, they had very little. They couldn't afford the big bands until the big bands came out. So all those groups, especially the early doo-wop groups and the Ink Spots.
No, particularly the
baritone.
They all
did their own music with their human voice.
Particularly the baritone guys doing the bass lines.
Oh, the bass line. Oh, yeah, exactly. Right. And they were emulating, the bass instruments. Amazing what used to go on in those records.
Well, great luck with that book. That sounds wonderful, Bruce. And, again, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Always nice talking to you.
Yeah, great.
Okay.